Okay, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. Only 2 hours left to Lollapalooza, and we can move on and be a regular Chicago again. My guest for this first segment, Lollapalooza is right in his backyard. He's Carlos Kalmer, who's been the artistic director and principal conductor of the Grant Park Music Festival for how long now, Carlos?
It's already 20 years.
So you knew the Petrillo Band show, did you?
Oh, I knew it very, very well.
Talk to me about the difference between, you were at Petrillo probably for your first 2 or 3 years. I can't remember exactly when Pritzker began.
Pritzker began in 2004, so I started in 2000, so a bunch of years in Petrillo. Petrillo was actually nice. I liked it too. But it, of course, had a very different vibe, and needless to say, the Petrillo was this place that the specialist knew where it was, but it's this place still is. Mm-hmm. It's hidden behind trees, and you have to know a little bit about
it. It's a secret. It's a secret band
show. How Grant Park functions. And then, of course, Pritzker Pavilion, the entire Millennium Park was built.
Yeah.
Thanks, of course, to the initiative of Mayor Daley, but there were so many wonderful individuals here in Chicago we have to thank for, because they put money on the on the project.
The Pritzker being where it is as part of the Millennial Park scene, it must have in some small but maybe a more obvious way changed the nature of the audience. Yes or no?
Actually, the only thing I would correct in what you're saying is small. It changed big time. So this is what happened. And just so everybody understand what's the difference. The Petrillo Shell is, if I may pull out a comparison out of the hat, is like you are driving a wonderful 25-year-old Ford. It's working, it's sturdy, it moves, it does what it does. And then all of a sudden, somebody gives you the keys to a brand new Mercedes, last technology, everything is working, high-powered engine, blah, 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 blah. And this is what it is. So, when in Petrillo we had a good night, we had around, let's say, between 2,500 and 3,000 people in attendance.
That's a good night.
That was a good night.
Yeah.
That, for the Pritzker Pavilion, is a bad night. We actually don't do that. That doesn't happen.
I can't imagine how you could. Yeah,
it simply doesn't happen. So I don't
You would find 2,000 people who don't even know where they're going, strolling in and sitting down.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, our seating area alone is 4,000, and then there is the lawn behind it, and when it's packed, it's really packed, and I'm sure we have more than 10,000 people out there. But that's not all. It's also that the sound system of the Pritzker Pavilion is to die for, and you are performing in a piece of art.
Art, no question.
Yes, I always say that you can put actually the stage in any concert hall of the world, and it will work really well. But this imagination of Frank Gehry constructing this and building this added to the richness of Chicago architecture another gem.
During the winter, when you are out there as the musical director of the Oregon Symphony Orchestra, when do you start to get excited about the more than 10 weeks you are going to spend in Chicago? And I'm talking to you now after about the five nicest summer days I've ever experienced in my many years here. When do you start? It must be, in a sense, even though you're devoted to the Oregon Symphony Orchestra, you must start planning. It must be a year-round kind of thing for you, is it not, Chicago?
Of course it is. Yeah. First of all, I come to the so-called gala here at Grant Park that we do in Chicago, which is most of the time around October. Then I visit during the winter time. So I've seen, trust me, I've seen many times Chicago in winter, and so I know that there is a different temperature and a different vibe in the city.
I love the way you say I've seen it in winter. You and your family live full time in Oregon, do you not? That is because you have seen Chicago in winter, I would think.
I wouldn't mind the cold. I mean, it's just a different thing, but I mean, I get excited. The first time I get really excited is when we plan the season, which is
sure.
more than a year out.
Of course.
And then I start to, the season starts to get shape. And at the end of the current year, we are going to have the next year already done, plus maybe some things for in 2 years. And so there is a lot to look forward. And I always look at the season and think, there are many thoughts.
Oh, I'm sure.
Have I pleased all what you call all my constituents? Meaning, I have such a diversity in the audience. I have the people in the audience who absolutely want to hear the War Horses, meaning they want
yeah,
Beethoven, Five, Tchaikovsky,
Brahms,
four,
yeah.
blah. Yeah. And I, of course, am very keen to please them. Then I have the people who are have been regulars of our friends at CSO and Lyric, and they definitely don't want to hear that
mm-hmm.
because they had. So they want to hear things they don't know. Then there are the people who go with us because we play a lot of American music. And then there is an entire, and I would say large amount of people who actually come because we are a free festival. And
exactly.
this is their
yeah.
exposure
yeah.
to classical music. And for that alone, I would say we are crucial for the make of Chicago and its culture.
Do you think, and you're going to be on long enough for us to go all over the map here, do you think that in a sense, by doing what you do and the element of it being free, that you are nurturing a new generation of classical music listeners?
Of course I think so. I think that essentially we are one of the most important tools in this city of Chicago.
I can imagine, yeah.
Because even though every institution, whether it's an orchestra, it's an opera, it's a theater, they want to get the young people.
Of course.
I mean, we are building
and
for the
we're
next
all
generation.
Not, and we're not Lollapalooza. I don't know how they do it. But Lollapalooza is most certainly not free.
It's not. But and all the other institutions need the revenue from the tickets.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we don't need private money or money from
corporations. Oh, of course not. Sure.
Yes, we do. And
sure.
we fundraise and we have a wonderful department for that. But essentially, the City of Chicago Department for Cultural Affairs and the parks give us at least half of the budget.
That's good.
And that is why we keep our festival free. And thus, we have so many people whose first exposure to classical music is our festival. And so what I think is we give them what they see. It's actually very high level, very good classical music performed by a fantastic orchestra and a phenomenal chorus and great soloists. They will later go on to, they will come back to us because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then they probably will gravitate to, okay, I heard Grand Park. It's actually fun. Let's go and check out the CSO. Let's go check out the Sinfonietta. What is Lyric doing? And so we are...
That would be good because, as you know, those institutions such as the CSO and Lyric are desperate for financial survival. And they need to cultivate the crowd that you are nurturing.
Yeah, and I'm sure that for me, all of these institutions, they are just friends. Even that changed so much over the many years I have been here. When I came here, I didn't know much about Grand Park, to tell you the truth, meaning
the
festival.
What drew you here? I want to go back, too, to you and, you growing up in Uruguay and learning to play the violin, because my father learned to play the violin, gave it up very fast when he was a child. But what drew you? You had a lot of international conducting experience, even 20 years ago. And what is it that drew you to Chicago?
Actually, the incentive came from my management, who said to me, look, there is this festival in Chicago. It's very interesting. They are probably going to grow over the years, although she at the time didn't know that actually Pritzker is going to happen.
Yeah.
So she just thought this is a good place artistically. Just check it out. And I came here, and the president of the festival, Jim Palermo, who later became a really very good friend of mine, thought, oh, this is interesting what this young man does. Let's give him a concert next year, and if he survives that, then maybe we can cut a deal. And here I am 20 years later. But at the beginning, 20 years ago, I thought, okay, there is Grand Park. As I described, it's hidden behind the trees. The festival for classical music in Chicago is Ravinia and the CSO.
Yeah. Yeah.
And over 20 years, I don't need to describe it in detail, but that has changed dramatically.
I couldn't agree
the
more.
The classical music festival in the summer is the Grand Park Music Festival.
No question. No question.
And Ravinia has gravitated towards being very successful, but something else.
Something complete. Tony Bennett, we have to take a little break. I'm going to continue my conversation with Carlos Kelmer. I need to ask him a million questions about musicians and about music and about the 2 weeks left or month left in the Grand Park Music Festival. 2 weeks left, but it's free, ladies and gentlemen. If you didn't go to Lollapalooza and your kids come home tonight, say, kids, we're spending the next 2 weeks at the Grand Park Music Festival. All of you people who paid those extravagant prices for your kids to go nuts over the last 4 days at Lollapalooza, which is held, of course, in Grant Park, I want you to go to the website, grantparkmusicfestival.com. Find something over the next 2 weeks that you, as adults, would like to see. It will not cost you a penny because the concerts are free. And tell your kids, we're going to Grant Park for 2 weeks and see what they say. One of the people you'll be seeing is Carlos Kelmer, is the artistic director and principal conductor, also the man who made the decision to bring the great Mambo Kings there this Wednesday. Something that has ever intrigued me, Carlos, is the role of a conductor. I'm sure there are some who see themselves as the leading man of the show, of the sort of star of the festivities. And I know others who think of themselves, in a sense, as one of the musicians. How do you see your role?
I think if I can quote something in Latin.
Sure, we have a sophisticated audience.
Yeah, of course. So it's primus inter pares, meaning the first amongst equals. Which, essentially, I don't need to do all this brouhaha I'm the star or so on, because, essentially, of course I'm the leading person.
Sure.
I don't need to hammer that into anybody's face. I just think that it's more important that one realizes that a conductor alone doesn't make any kind of noise.
It's not even interesting, no matter how much you dance or jump around.
Yeah,
the star, if I can ask you, the star of a symphony concert, I think, and I've always thought of, as the composer.
The star is the composer.
Okay.
The instrument is the orchestra. And yes, I play a very, very crucial role. No kidding, but there is no reason why to put conductors on a pedestal. Period.
There are some who think differently than you.
That's okay.
I don't need you to name names. I don't want you to name names.
That is okay.
But that must make your relationship with the musicians less tense than it might otherwise be. Yes.
I hope so, but yeah. But I would say you have to ask the musicians. Because
sure.
The musicians, I think, this is only a thought of mine, they will tell you, yeah, that's actually the truth, what I'm telling you, but Carlos is demanding. Just watch out.
Yeah, you should see him in rehearsal.
He does think
he's the star. Talk to me for a second about the dedication and artfulness of symphony players is sometimes vastly underrated because they're just, they're a bunch of violins there and they're a bunch of people here. Could you talk to me, the artistry and dedication of these individuals that make up that whole is often ignored.
And it should not be ignored. Let me just give you a very simple example that actually applies to pretty much every musician on stage that you see here in Grand Park. these wonderful individuals who might be anywhere between 24 and 60-some years old, they all started with their instrument between ages probably 4 and maximum 10.
You started at 6.
I started at 6. Well, I'm a string player. If you are 10 and you start with a string player, it is going to be very tricky for you. But, I mean, there are miracles. Anyway,
yeah. Okay.
But I need everybody to really understand that all these individuals, me included, of course, we have dedicated our life to exactly that.
Yeah.
We have sacrificed, to some extent, parts of our childhood because we needed to practice while our friends were playing basketball or baseball or what,
or watching TV,
like that.
Or playing on their phone.
Yeah, that's the modern version. And we went through puberty, etc., etc. Then we studied. Then we applied for a job, which is tremendously difficult to get because competition is fierce. And now, let's assume you get a real job after being vetted and going through an entire process that is grueling. Then you have to do something what I call, you have to keep your chops up.
Sure.
This is not a profession at all where, okay, I have a job for life. I'm a tenured musician. I stop practicing right away. No such thing happens. You keep on doing that until the day you decide, okay, it's enough. I have done 40 or whatever years of this. I want to do something else. It's a personal decision. The learning never, ever stops. And in particular, I have to talk about the musicians who are working here at Grand Park Music Festival.
How do they come to the Grand Park Music Festival? I know they come from a variety of places. They're not waiting in some cave for you to say, hey, it's summertime, come on, let's play.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, wouldn't that be easy on you?
They go through the same audition process as you go when you apply for a job at the CSO. It's exactly the same process, and they have to survive several rounds. Now, the musicians of this orchestra at Grand Park Music Festival, a certain percentage, maybe 20 of them, are Lyric Opera Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
There is maybe 10, 15 are freelancers here in Chicago, and the rest is from everywhere in the United States. I have people from Phoenix, I have people from New Mexico, I have people from Virginia, etc. I even have a very wonderful man who plays the bassoon. Our principal bassoon is from Toronto in Canada.
And is
they
it
all come?
Is it, and not to turn you into a star again, I assume that some of them know of your work, and some of them are drawn to you. I wouldn't argue that for a second. Many of them are drawn to the reputation of the orchestra. Many others are drawn to, hey, I'd like to spend a couple months in Chicago. They are drawn for a variety of reasons, yes?
Correct. There are so many advantages to actually spend the summer in Chicago. Chicago is a fantastic city, and you know it.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell you that. The festival is a fantastic venue. The artistry displayed there is very, very high. The only, if I may say so, disadvantage...
Sure.
with a twinkle in my eyes, it's a lot of work.
I don't doubt that for a second.
Yeah, I mean, we here at Grand Park Music Festival offer 3 concerts every week, and it's 2 different programs, and the programs are very diverse, and most of the time the musicians are confronted with music they have never seen before. There are 2 weeks left now of the festival. Yes, we are going to work with the Mambo Kings, which will be a great deal of fun. Not even a question.
Wednesday night, ladies and gentlemen.
But Friday, Saturday, we are going to play A Mass of Life by Frederick Delius. Trust me, nobody knows this piece.
Well, that's good, because I love the idea of exposing. There are a lot of people who will be there Wednesday night who do not know and have never heard of the Mambo Kings, too. So you are introducing people always, you were making introductions to people of new music in their lives.
The thing is, in our festival, we have so much to offer. So you want to have some fun with some lighter, a little bit, let's say, pop sphere, Mambo Kings. We also do a Broadway show. You want
right.
the heavy, romantic English music with a great deal of intellectuality, you come next weekend to the Delius. You want one of the best pieces written in symphonic music, you come at the end of the festival, Mahler Second. You want exposure to female composers, well, there's one chance, which is 7 days after the next Wednesday, and we are going to play Amy Beach, a piece that I'm sure nobody has ever heard.
Not
variations
I.
on Balkan themes.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So it's everything is there. Just come.
This is one of the great salesmen I've ever known. The park is a great sales place. The Pritzker Pavilion is a great venue. You have played, I'm going to let you go a little early, but you have played all over the world. You know the scene, the classical music scene, the orchestra scene all over this planet. Let me ask you, if you could, in a couple minutes, the differences between, are there vast differences between Europe, let's say, and the United States? I know you have to make a real generalization. You also run the music director of the Oregon Symphony Orchestra. Are there, in the audience, in the type of music presented, are there lines of difference that you can see, that you can hear?
I can tell you an answer that I would have given you probably 18 years ago.
Okay.
Which is the difference in orchestras is that American orchestras tend to be technically more skilled. They
really?
And, yeah, 18 years ago.
Okay.
And second, I always tell this, it's not even an anecdote, it's like, so American orchestras' demeanor towards when they work with a conductor is, I want to do whatever you tell me to do. European, especially German orchestras, where I have spent most of
sure.
my life before I started working here extensively, have the demeanor, I need to do what you're telling me, but I'd rather do it the way I want it. That's 18
yeah.
years ago. Let's just remember one thing which applies to music and classical orchestras the same as it applies to every business. There is globalization. So we are all now mixed up, and you have to work very, very hard to make your orchestra to have a very distinctive approach
yeah.
to whatever you do. I can tell you one thing. The Grand Park Music Festival Orchestra is a phenomenal orchestra and probably the fastest orchestra you can find in this planet, because I don't know any orchestra who just pulls out concert after concert of music that in part they don't know, and they are there. And on top of that, we have a chorus with my friend Christopher Bell, who is the chorus director, which is to die for.
Yeah.
So there are many reasons to come to us.
Carlos Camel, you're a Chicago treasure. That's all I can say. You really are, and I'm glad you run that thing. Please go to GrantParkMusicFestival.com for the upcoming schedule for the next 2 weeks, and lock your kids in the closet and tell them you're going to Grant Park for 2 weeks. Carlos, it's great to see you again, and best of luck.
Thank you very much.
We will be back. I'm going to spend 5 minutes talking to a guest from Ireland. This is such an international show. And then we'll have Howard Tolman in here to tell you all how to be entrepreneurs. Welcome back. Carlos Kelmer was a cool guy. I have in the studio a visitor from Ireland, Tony G. Used to be on the radio in Ireland, right?
That's right, Rick,
and still am. You are?
Yeah, but not as much as I used to be because of work commitments.
Well, it's probably more than I'm on the radio. I'm only on 2 days a week. What do you think, for instance, of these studios? I'm sure Irish studios are fantastic. What do you think of these?
Amazing. And you have your own sound engineer. When I do the programs back in Ireland, I have to do my own sound engineering.
Now you're making me feel terrible. You're making me feel like I don't know anything about this. You haven't been in Chicago in almost 30 years, and you have spent the last 3 days sort of getting a tour from the, you know, O'Briens and the Hessians and some of your other relatives here. What are your impressions?
I love Chicago. I loved it in 1995 when I was over last time, which is a long, long time ago. And I love it even more now because I've got to see more of the city and got to explore more of the city. And I think it's just a fabulous city. It's my favorite American city.
And,
and I've been to a lot of
listen to this. We're sitting here with Howard Tolman, too, who's going to be on all the way till 20 after 10. Howard's new book is You Can't Win a Race in Your with Your Mouth. It is 300 chapters of, to my mind, unbelievably insightful things. And the only thing you two guys have in common right now, Tony G and Howard Tolman, as far as I know, is you both been to the Billy Goat.
We're grossly underdressed.
Immensely so.
You know? You know, this is radio, boys. This is radio.
Nobody can see us.
Yeah, I'm the idiot in a sweater vest, and Dan has a hat on. Ro is as stylish as she always is. You're also going, though. You're going to San Francisco, you're going to Las Vegas and
yeah.
Then you're going to Boston.
Well, no, next year I'm doing St. Louis and Boston.
And what about Chicago? It's right in the middle.
Well, I'm doing Chicago this year, so I can't do everywhere. America is just big.
Howard, how much traveling do you do? I mean, you must have in your career done
well, yeah,
a ton.
In my career a lot. I think I travel probably 4 or 5 days a month. Yeah.
Doing what?
Speeches.
Yeah.
Mostly speeches.
But, Tony, stay on with this. I think you might find this interesting. This book that is sitting in front of me, You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth. It is 300 chapters. The subtitle is, and You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth, and 299 Other Expert Tips from a Lifelong Entrepreneur. I knew you when you were entrepreneuring, when you had started a place called Flashpoint Academy.
Right.
Which was a heavy, heavy advertiser on WGN in the day. And you invited me over to see Flashpoint Academy, and you took me on a tour, and I literally, my eyes fell out of my head. I literally thought that I was seeing the future. Was I?
Well, it's turned out to be a future that keeps moving. You know, one of the interesting things about the world today is the present has never been more temporary.
Interesting,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and nothing is the future forever. And, you know, so, yeah, back then it was revolutionary for two reasons. One was it was a 2-year high-end vocational college. And the idea was there were a bunch of kids who that's what they wanted to do with their lives,
yeah.
You know, whether it was film or computer or game development or broadcast or animation. And there wasn't a channel or a place where they could go.
They had to kind of try to go to the normal, regular academic route.
Yeah, and they would go to a 4-year school and discover that the first 2 years they weren't doing anything that they were passionate or excited about. So this was built for all those parents who were afraid their kids were going to, like, live in their basement forever. Or,
well, that's still happening
exactly.
Now. Yeah, it's still.
But, and that's grown into, you know, digital was ahead of its time. I mean, honestly.
Yeah. Well, I'll never forget there, and Tony, that Howard said, watch this. And he sort of moved his hand over a screen, and it was revolutionary to
yeah.
me. I don't remember what you were doing. You were like,
well, those were the earliest controls that we had. Now we use voice. It's the same now.
Yeah.
It's voice. You
yeah.
know?
You write in the book, over the last 50 years, I've watched and worked with hundreds of entrepreneurs who have won many hard-fought and difficult battles to turn their dreams into reality, and who have also lost as many contests as well. The main lesson is quite simple. The best of them took what they learned from both the ups and downs and never gave up. Before you got into this world, I don't know much about your childhood or your background and how you wound up being able to, for the last 30 years to do such. 50 years.
Right.
You look so young. You look so young. Tony, he doesn't look like you've done anything for 50
definitely
years.
Not. Yeah.
74.
Wow.
It's frightening.
Yeah, you look good. That's another thing for the entrepreneurs out there. You will never age. What did you do before? I mean, no one is born. Maybe people are born entrepreneurs.
You know, this is an ongoing conversation, which is nature versus nurture.
Sure.
And I think I just wrote a column 2 weeks ago about the fact that I think parents don't get enough credit. I mean, they're the ones, especially mothers, who, you know, give you sort of unconditional love. You have to sort of earn your dad's respect, you know. They're tough. But and I think that I had that kind of support. I had that kind of support when I was a kid. I mean, my first business was when I was like 10.
And what was it?
And I was a magician.
Where did you grow up?
Before in Highland Park and before that in St. Louis. So, but I think that, you know, in my grown-up career, I was a trial lawyer for about 10 years. And then I retired in 1980 and started my first business. And it was an information technology business, which is now 40 years old.
What compelled you to get in the law?
Well,
and was that some parental pressure too?
No, actually, you know, I had thought that it was going to be a different kind of career, and it turned out to be different. I mean, I had a very peculiar experience. The first 5 years were all about broad spectrum class actions, which were just coming into vogue, and the next 5 years were about Chapter 11. So, you know, these were two very interesting and serious moves in terms of the way the legal profession changed.
Sure.
And so I did that for about 10 years. And what emerged was the most interesting part of it was not whether you won an individual case or lost one. It was that the requirements for managing information, you know, we had a typical case, 50,000 claimants. And you start to think about some clerk with a bag of mail, you know,
something
that was larger than him every single day for the rest of his life. Yeah. So computers were just, again, just beginning to be a tool for managing this kind of stuff. And so I was right there at that sort of time. And that channel and that sort of path was more attractive than continuing to be a lawyer. So that's what I did.
So what did you start?
So the first business I started was...
In Chicago.
The first of about five businesses, all of which were based on the same sort of premise, which was that information becomes more valuable the closer it gets to real time. So if you think about that, it's, you know, it becomes pretty obvious. If you were a stock trader, you'd need information in the second. But if you were writing a bill of the history of, you know, stock trading or something, then, you know, you could use different kinds of data. So the first of our businesses was to help insurance companies figure out what a car was worth. It was the first database of collecting real-time market information. And then we did cars, boats, real estate, jobs, just about everything.
Yeah.
We did all the first databases for
this. Was it exciting and satisfying for you? I have to think.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. That business has today about 6,000 employees. It's worth about $3 billion, and it's still up and operating, you know, which is frightening. And
you don't still own it, though?
No, okay. but we sold it after the first time we sold it was in 1987 for about $100 million, which back then was real money.
What, Howard, I don't know where you're from, but that's real money now.
Yeah,
that's real money.
I guess. Although everything is a bit. My brother just had an IPO 2 weeks ago. It was like $2 billion or something for valuation. And, you know, I remind him that he's my youngest brother. So it's really humiliating.
Well, in this book, what I find, it's a wonderfully, I know for 300 some stories and more, way more than 300 pages, at 484 pages. These are a gathering of columns that you wrote over the last
few years
for Inc. magazine.
Right.
What compelled you to put them together in a book?
Well, you know, I think the biggest idea was that this is sort of a curriculum. And, you know, we're teaching now entrepreneurship. I mean, everybody wants to be an entrepreneur, and
exactly.
I'm hoping that will actually, you know, get that virus extended into the high schools and even maybe into the lower levels of school. And the reason that I think we have a shot that we maybe didn't have before is that it used to be the two dreams were you could be a jock or you could be a rock star. And that would be how you would get out of the inner city, let's say.
I still have those dreams.
Yeah, I believe it.
Those are my aspirations.
And today, the sea change has been that all the jocks and all the rock people want to be entrepreneurs as well.
Yeah,
so now we have it going our way. And I think kids, when you go into any school in America, the people with the lights on, the kids with the lights on, are not the kids doing the core curriculum. It's the kids who have an ownership connection and are vested in band, chess, robotics, you name it, anything but. And
they're
we
not
have
the
to
kids.
Make the core curriculum.
They're not the kids doing
challenging again.
Doing push-ups.
Yeah.
I'm going to spend at least the next half hour with Howard Tolman and Tony G. Tony, you get into this too, because you and I can become some kind of entrepreneurs. That would be Howard Tolman's greatest challenge, to turn me
Here's what I would say. The job description entrepreneur, maybe not. The need to be entrepreneurial in life, for sure. Life skills.
You know, this book and these chapter titles and the way in which you've written them, these are lessons for life.
Yeah,
whether
exactly.
you want to be an entrepreneur or you want to be sell a hot dog.
Totally.
Sell a hot dog. We got to take a little commercial break, and we'll be back, and we'll carry on this conversation. Welcome back. This book, You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth, and 299 Other Expert Tips from a Lifelong Entrepreneur, is the work of Howard Tolman, who is a lifelong entrepreneur. But this book, gathering these many, many, many life lessons that I think, and I can barely balance a checkbook and have no entrepreneurial spirit that has ever been discovered. This is a book about life, Howard. I hope you take that as a compliment, too. We were talking with Tony G, who has a sports radio show in Ireland, and there are sports lessons in
here. Sure.
Give me a for instance.
Well, we were just saying that every great athlete learns early on to practice what we call, you know, in-game amnesia. And what that means is you got to let the past be behind you. If you're focusing on a missed call or, a mistake, then you're not looking ahead. And
yeah.
You're not going to succeed looking in the rearview mirror. That's exactly the same thing we tell entrepreneurs all the time. You want to learn from the lessons, but you don't want to dwell on them. You know, we can't be prisoners of our past, really.
Don't you think in the past, since Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, that many people are a little misguided when they say they want to be entrepreneurs because what they mean is I want to be really rich?
Well, that's for sure. And the last thing I always say in these talks is that the truth is it's not about big cars or homes and money. It's about having this unbelievable privilege of going someplace every day where you can be enthusiastic about what you're doing.
Exactly.
And, you know, you work a third of your life, or maybe, you know, a third of every single day. And it's just too painful and too hard not to be passionate and excited about what you're doing.
One of the other things that you did, and where I bumped into you again,
I can't get rid of you.
No, we mostly bump into each other at Billy Goat. I'm
right.
in there having a drink, and Howard comes in to get food. Very few people I know, very few adults get food to go at Billy Goat and get back in their car.
Well, you know, we now have a goat in the mart where I
know.
Spend a great deal of time.
So I know. It's not quite the same.
Right.
But in the mart, Howard was the first director, I guess is the right title, of 1871, this tech hub, a nurturing ground for people with ideas.
Yeah.
Is that well put? Or?
Yeah, it was. So it started actually, look, J.B. Pritzker was actually the founding visionary. I got involved about a year into it when it became clear that it needed to be a business, not just a grand adventure.
Not just a bunch of couches.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have had at the time about 500 startups, about 2,000 people a day, and it became the number one incubator in the world. There's actually somebody who measures those things. And it changed Chicago. You know, in six years, tech went from about 2% of the city economy to about 14%. That's about 165,000 jobs. And Chicago's now on the map. Chicago is number maybe 2, 3, 4 in terms of, you know, tech ecosystems. One of the things that 1871 did was it pulled and it encouraged a tremendous number of companies that had been in the burbs forever to move back to the city. I mean, whether it's McDonald's or Allstate or all of these organizations, for a variety of reasons, including that you couldn't get tech or creative or digital talent to move or to commute and spend a couple of hours a day doing that. So the
People would come in and pitch you? Is that how one got
into 1871? When it started, you know, it was pretty much Anybody who said they had a business idea or were an entrepreneur could come in. And then you discover, by the time I took over day-to-day responsibility, first of all, that kills your culture if half the people are there because their parents figured it's cheaper to rent them a desk than to have them in the basement, right? So you need to actually have it be people who are a little more serious.
Sure.
It's not a, it's not a playground. Entrepreneurial petting zoo.
Right, right.
Although the corporations would come through and say, hey, maybe a little innovation will rub off if we walk around here enough. And then the other part was we added a question that said, how is your business going to make a difference? And the theory was it couldn't just be about making a living. It had to be about making a life. Wow. And you had to sort of be aimed at making a contribution that was going to be more important than just, I want to make a lot of money.
God, good for you, and good for JB, too. One part of the book, there are three different parts of this, is and that I was very intrigued by, make room for people.
Yeah.
What's that mean?
Well, first of all, it means that we think that, and especially entrepreneurs think that you build a business by finding eight people exactly like you, all type A. And, this probably goes back to Vince Lombardi or one of these guys who said, you want to play not your 11 best, but your best 11. And it's all about team. And so making room for people is an acknowledgement that we think that, we understand and we want creativity and talent. We don't understand that it's a package deal. And that means some of the people don't think that bathing is a daily ritual. Some of the people want to work overnight only. And you know what? If you don't build your business that in an inclusive fashion and a way that takes into account that you need people with different skill sets, it's never going to be as successful as it could be. So making room for people is creating the space for everybody to bring their talents and sort of everything else that they have to do.
Who do you think in our lifetime, and I may not even know the person, but who do you think is the classic entrepreneur? I mean, I think most people would knee-jerk a Steve Jobs, as complicated and screwed up as
he
was. Yeah,
I think that, Microsoft grew so fast that we think of it as a corporation. But the guy who has been around, the two guys are Gates and Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
I mean, these are two people that have built, gargantuan enterprises and have survived all the phases. Usually an entrepreneur would be very lucky to last till the company had 100 or 200 employees.
Sure.
And these guys have thousands of employees or hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, Bezos is the guy who really fascinates me.
I think he
literally
is.
Started in a garage.
Yeah, and Steve, I knew Steve Jobs.
Sure.
And he had some interesting aspects. One goes back to this amnesia thing, which is he was a great liar. And the minute he would change his mind, he would deny that he ever said anything in the past. And when you would really press him and you'd say, I have video of this, I have it written down, he'd say, he would never apologize, but he would say, I'm doing what's right for the business right now. And that was about all you could do. In other words, you had to be in the moment and you had to be learning from the past, but you had to sort of always be building, looking forward.
Which leads me to, and we could, I mean, Howard could stay on, Howard Tolman could stay on for the next 8 hours and elaborate on many of these chapters. Fascinated with the one, innovation beats invention, hands down.
Yeah, people don't understand that inventing is hard. Inventing is really difficult. You have to believe that you're going to bring something new into existence and that the dogs are going to eat the dog food, right? Innovation is just a scientific process. It's just getting a little better every single day. So it's iterative. You test stuff out and you build on it and you abandon what isn't working and you go forward with the stuff that is working. And, people think it's risky. It's not risky at all. I mean, it's just a concept. I call it successive approximation as opposed to postponed perfection. If you're waiting for something to drop from the skies that's perfect, you can wait a long time.
But
if you're building and if you're constantly iterating, then it's just a process. And we think that you can make it into a complete science, that there's an absolute ability to do that. And when you go back to this nature versus nurture thing, what I say about entrepreneurs is I can't make you lean in that crazy direction, but we can make you a lot better because there are a set of skills, including pattern recognition, including how do you iterate, including getting started and then, you know, sort of quickly failing. All of these things are just technical capabilities.
What does an entrepreneur need, though? Are there qualities that
customers. Customers, you know, in the list of let me tell you a mathematical proposition, and especially in these crazy times where you could raise money from a bunch of lunatics for anything.
Exactly.
The real test is that $1 from a customer is worth $10 from an investor,
and that's
true. Because you can burn through a lot of investors' money and still not determine whether you have a real business. But customers give it to you straight, and customers determine whether you have a sustainable business. So all the rest of the things, technology and talent and all those things, are subordinate to customers.
I'm talking to Howard Tolman and Tony G, talking about his book, You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth, and 299 Other Expert Tips from a Lifelong Entrepreneur. It is also, it's an amazing book about life. You may, you know, not read every one of the 300 chapters, but almost, I cannot imagine anybody not getting a great deal of value out of this book. Go to Amazon, you'll find it. We're going to continue this conversation after the news because I find Howard very interesting and he eats at the Billy Goat Tavern. So there you go. Thanks, Roger. The chapter, I'll call it chapter 274 in Howard Tolman's You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth and 299 Other Expert Tips from a Lifelong Entrepreneur is a terribly intriguing title. Facebook is failing and Twitter is toast. What's that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, we're seeing that user engagement with Facebook continues to fall off.
Yeah.
And forget all of the other issues. I mean, the stock has continued to perform inexplicably wonderfully because they're not really in the business of serving you and me. They sell audiences to advertisers, right?
They're in
and
the
that's
business.
Working.
They're in the business of using you and me.
Right. We're the product.
Yes.
You know, this is like who's the patsy in the poker game. If you don't know, it's you, right? So the, you know, Facebook is at this point, I mean, the measurement is if I'm not on and I'm not engaged, then, you know, then I'm not really going to be very successful. And honestly, what we're seeing is less and less people are engaging in it. Their godsend for them has been the acquisition of Instagram and the acquisition of WhatsApp, and that's where all the action is. So that's keeping in the game. But it's going to, you know, we're going to see. I mean, Twitter would have been dead by now except for really for Trump. I mean, Trump has been a one-man, you know, reinvigoration of Twitter. We'll see what happens with social media. It's become, you know, this gigantic beast.
And swamp.
And
beast.
You know, I think Lady Gaga said it best. She said that social media is the toilet of the internet.
Yeah. Interesting. You were mentioning that you think one element of our future, and you're not a futurist. You are someone who likes to talk to people with ideas. Voice.
Yeah, voice is coming, and you know we don't understand how significant a change it has been already. That we used to use our phones, we used to use all these devices to talk to someone else. It was a vehicle
communication.
And today we're talking to the phone itself. We're talking to the machine, right? We're asking it questions and it's giving us answers. There's no other human there, and that's a huge change in behavior. And I'll tell you what I tell parents of young kids all the time is they should go home and they should decide whether to teach their kids, this is anybody under about 5 years old, to say thank you to Alexa. And here's why. Because if they don't teach their kids some basic etiquette and some basic courtesy, when their kids get into school, they're going to be the most demanding little monsters in the world. And that's how they're growing up. It's like, Alexa, play me a song. Nobody says thank you. You know, nobody asks permission. You know, you demand. And so we're training these kids, and they don't know anything, you know, other than that. That's how they
interact. Teacher, give me an A.
Totally. Totally.
Teacher, give me, coach, give me the ball.
So voice is going to change that. Voice is also going to change the way that, you know, if you're looking at a computer screen and somebody says, I want this answer, you know, you'll accommodate a list of about 10 items. if you are using your phone, maybe four or five things is about all that will show up on that very scarce piece of real estate. Voice is one answer. Voice is, we want the answer to my question. I don't want you to read me a list. And so the jockeying for how do you become the space number one, how do you become the answer, is going to be more and more intense than ever, and voice is going to drive that.
That's fascinating. When you think, when one thinks on entrepreneurs, you think Silicon Valley, and you think the entrepreneurs of our modern age will be the people who make our future. But then you think of a country like China, where from what I've read, and it's very modest reading, I don't know anything really, that so many more resources are being given to not entrepreneurs in the way that we in America think of them, but in people who are trying to make new things, not so much for their own financial benefit, but for the idea of making new things.
I don't know if that's right. I would say three things are going on in China. One, they have an enormous advantage because we spawn 10 or 20 companies on a single idea, and they compete with each other. In China, one company is designated by the government to be the winner. And so that is an enormous advantage. That's number one.
Sure.
We talked about AI before. AI is dependent on the size of the set of data that you have. In this country, we're doing all these dances around privacy and things like that. In China, they have
no privacy.
Ubiquitous, no yeah. privacy. Yeah. They have billions of pieces of data. They're winning the AI race for that reason. And then thirdly, I wouldn't say that they're engaged at all in inventing new things for the sake of inventing new things. What they're engaged in is stealing IP from the U.S. and figuring out how to cheaply replicate just about everything here. You know, if you look at what's gone on, all the successful companies in the United States have been knocked off in China. They haven't succeeded. I mean, Amazon,
An
idea, Amazon's been there 20 years. They have 1% of the market. They just closed their Amazon business in China. Starbucks has been there 20 years. It's their biggest market worldwide. In the next 6 months, a startup in China funded by China will have more Starbucks locations or more coffee locations in China than Starbucks has after 20 years.
Wow.
And that's a 3-year-old business. Because
so their notion of competition is not
existent. No, it's a government.
It's annihilation.
So they've closed off search. They've closed off some of these marketplaces. And Alibaba and these companies are doing exceedingly well. And they're, you know, that economy, the thing that we should learn from that economy is the amazing extent to which it's entirely mobile. I mean, you do everything through WeChat now using your phone. It's just astonishing. Nobody uses cash, nobody uses anything. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
And it's going to imperil the banks. You know, I always tell people that one of the largest banks in the United States is Starbucks, which it is because the deposits on the cards are the size in the aggregate of probably the 12th largest bank in this country.
What did Starbucks do right?
I think that Starbucks has figured out that they might as well have these mobile-only stores, because I think there was going to be a revolution where the poor suckers who were standing in line while hundreds of mobile people were getting served first were about to kill those people. So if you look, Starbucks is changing the size and shape of the stores. And they'll be smaller, and they'll be where you literally go to pick up your Starbucks. They've also figured out they have no solution for what do you do with homeless people and people that are living in the Starbucks.
Sure.
Now. So they're getting rid of furniture. They're shrinking the footprint of the Starbucks.
What did they do right at the beginning? One point, you know, they started in Seattle and Schultz and all that stuff.
I think Howard, I was his landlord first started.
Yeah, of course.
You know? And I think they discovered that there was a niche for, you know, coffee that wasn't crappy. And, they never succeeded in Israel That was a huge market. You would have thought that it would be ubiquitous there.
Sure.
Dunkin' Donuts has sort of taken share from them now. Now you have, you know, 10 or 20 other sort of new ideas around coffee. And frankly, McDonald's even snuck up and created sort of an upscale coffee with McCafe. And what they really did is they never admitted it, but they changed the mix to make that a much richer and more pleasant coffee.
Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, so coffee's tough business.
I bet it is. Before I let you go, I'd love your impression, just given this book and given your theory about who is and what is an entrepreneur. Someone like Marshall Field, for instance, he didn't invent stores.
Right.
He was incredibly successful. Why?
Well, I think he was, you know, he was a guy who was early to the realization that we talk about today all the time,
yeah,
and that is customer experience.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Marshall Field's had a couple of different things going for it. One was the joke that, you know, you could take china that you got when you were married and 20 years later return it,
yeah,
you know. So, I mean, they had services. They had a sort of a culture that was really unique. I mean, you know, when you go back in the history, you have Tiffany's, you have Nordstrom's, which
sure
is a newbie, you have Field's. And they were all about brand in the way that brand was a promise, and they lived up to that promise.
And the title of my father's book was Give the Lady What She Wants, which was part of that whole culture. One last question. Again, Howard Tolman is talking, and Howard Tolman has written You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth and 299 Other Expert Tips from a Lifelong Entrepreneur. But he's not just a lifelong entrepreneur. He's a lifelong thinker. And that's what this book is about. I literally believe this book can be of value to anybody who does anything. How's that for a big umbrella?
That was good.
Yeah, not bad. What about, I want to end with Ray Kroc.
Yeah.
Not an inventor.
Well, he was,
he
was
an entrepreneur.
I mean,
a thief. Exactly. That's exactly right. That's another way to get rich, is to be a thief.
Listen, it's way better to let somebody else get all the arrows in their back and then go to school on them than it is to be a pioneer. You know, he was, listen, McDonald's was, and to this day, continues to be, you know, inventive in interesting ways.
No question.
But very much challenged. I mean, it's,
look.
I give them credit, and I'll tell you a very quick story. Okay, the story goes like this. 8 years ago, if you were a mother and said to your neighbors in the suburbs, I'm taking my kids to McDonald's, they would say, that's like poisoning your kids, literally. I mean, and that was as little as 8 years ago. About 5 years ago, they happened on all-day breakfast. And this plays to something that we were taught throughout our entire life, that breakfast is the most important meal.
Absolutely.
And so as a mom, you could say, I'm taking my kids to McDonald's for the healthy McDonald's food.
Yeah.
It's not that garbage, you know, that you think I'm poisoning them with. I'm taking them because breakfast is important. And they changed our perception in an amazing way about McDonald's. And, you know, now they're doing some other things that are sort of interesting, but that was the real revolution in terms of trying to save that brand, because it was in the
And one last thing, at the end of your book, which can be found on Amazon and every other place on the internet, again, the title is You Can't Win a Race with Your Mouth. The author is Howard Tolman, T-U-L-L-M-A-N. You have a number of ways in which people can reach you. You must get a lot of emails every day.
So I'll tell
you, Mr. Tolman, I have the greatest idea since the wheel.
Happens every day. Happens every day. And we say everybody has an idea. It's when you get out of the shower, what you do after that.
Dry off before you send Howard an email.
But I will tell you one last thing. The easiest way to get in touch with me is my last name, as you said, T-U-L-L-M-A-N, anywhere. So on the web or whatever, AOL. But when I did that, when in the beginning of the world, I used just my last name as opposed to Howard Tolman so that my brother would forever be in the shadow of having to deal with that. And this has been difficult for him. As
brother,
I said, it's
the brother with a $1 billion IPO.
Right.
Howard, it's great to see you. The Billy Goat's still open if you want to walk across the river and get some food.
Happy to do it.
Thank you so much. And
thanks for having me.
For this book. It was enlightening.
Great.
On all manner of levels. We'll take a little break, and we're going to talk about Chicago history and I don't know if you want to call him a gangster, but maybe the first crime king in the history of Chicago. I'll let you guess what his name was. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Tony G, where is your show broadcast throughout Ireland?
It's broadcast 32 counties on the island of Ireland, and six of them are Northern Ireland, 26 in the south, and Shannonside Northern Sound would broadcast to franchise with five of those counties, Longford, Roscommon, Leitrim, Cavan and Monaghan. But you'd have people from bordering counties who would tune in as well, so people in South Tyrone, South Armagh, and even parts of North Offaly and parts of Meath would tune into the station. So it's a vast audience.
I have to believe that you don't cover a lot of like American football and American baseball, do you?
No, I love.
Do you cover any American sports?
Well, on my sports beat show on a Monday, I've covered American sport because we tend to cover some quirky sports that wouldn't get massive coverage on the main sports shows as well.
Yeah.
So we'd often talk about American football, and we would also
talk... quirky sport. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah,
love
well, quirky sports from an Irish perspective.
Of course. Yeah. No, I'm not...
Although American football is quite popular in Ireland, and of course it's very popular in the UK with
all these games
playing in
London. They've started to play in London, yeah. So what are the main sports, forgive me because I can't tune you in, What main sports do you cover?
We cover soccer or football, as we call it back home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's referred to as soccer over here in the main, isn't it?
It is.
Gaelic football and hurling and rugby would be the four main sports. And then horse racing as well.
Explain hurling to me.
Hurling is a great game. I used to play it myself. I have a real passion for hurling. So it's
how do you play?
It's a form of hockey, I suppose you could say.
Okay.
It's the second fastest team sport in the world.
After what?
Pelotavaska, Hialeah.
Oh, wow.
Not everyone knows what that is, but that's played here in America.
Hialeah is mostly sort of a betting game
the ball off
here.
The wall and catch it and that.
So. I couldn't tell you. I saw Hialeah. I bet on Hialeah. I think I did it in Miami many years ago, but I don't think there's a lot of Hialeah around here. Yeah. Dan knows a lot about sports. Anything, Dan? What do you think? Have you ever seen Hialeah?
I've seen it, yeah, but my exposure is basically what you just said.
Yeah,
betting a little bit, and yeah, there's not that much. In the Chicagoland area.
You've only been here for less than a week, Tony, and I know you don't subscribe to American newspapers, but, America, the Bears will have practices that are attended by, thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. Is sports, does it dominate Irish culture in the same way that American sports?
Oh, it does, definitely. A lot of Irish people would live for sport. Sport and music.
Yeah.
And a lot of Irish culture, a lot of people have a passion for that as well. But sport and music are ever present in Irish lives, basically. And, it's as mainstay of people's lives in Ireland as it is here in America.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So as a sportscaster, do you find people coming up to you in pubs and wanting to have long conversations with you?
I tell you one American sport I really love is the ice hockey. I love the ice hockey. I watch the ice hockey back home, and the great thing is you can record ice hockey and nobody's going to spoil it. It's over at 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning in Ireland, so you have to record it and then you watch it the following evening. And nobody's going to spoil your fun by telling you, what do you think of St. Louis Blues against the Boston Bruins? Whereas if you record a soccer match or a Gaelic match, it's pointless because you'll find out somehow by some means or manner before you get to watch it what the result was. And
Who's the most famous athlete in Ireland?
Oh.
Who is he, like, compared to, let's say, Michael Jordan status here?
Well, you're looking at the likes of, I suppose, Rory McIlroy, although some people might say he's not pure Irish because he's from Northern Ireland.
Right.
But, of course, Shane Lowry won the Open there recently. So
now, how big a news was that?
Massive.
He was a charming guy. I watched him win. He ran away with
the
tournament.
He's a very affable individual.
Yes, he is.
Very friendly, very sociable. And there's a funny story, actually. The Open started on a Thursday. It always does, ends on a Sunday, like most golf tournaments. But there's a golf statistician who follows Shane Lowry, and Shane Lowry follows him back, and he finds his stats interesting. On the Monday before the Open, he came out with a stat that since man first walked on the moon, the average age of the Open winner is 32, and the average world ranking is 33. Shane Lowry is 32. He's ranked 33. He's going to win the Open next week. And he did.
Wow. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. How did you get into that radio thing in the first place?
I was asked to do a match because I do the public announcing at a Longford Town FC soccer game back home. So domestic soccer is reasonably big, but it's dwarfed by Gaelic football and hurling and rugby back home in Ireland.
Yeah.
But there's still a large following of soccer, but they mainly follow the Premier League teams. But there's a good support for the League of Ireland teams, and not a bad support. It's growing all the time.
Now, you said, and I know that there is a huge push by the NBA and the NFL to bring those games, you know, to the international market. Yeah. Have you seen anything sort of?
Well, yeah, at the college game, like Notre Dame would have played a couple of college games in Croke Park.
So
they're trying to bring that to Ireland as well, but I don't think it has. There's a large minority of people are beginning to get interested in American football. American football seems to be the one sport that everyone is beginning to get into in Ireland.
Yeah.
And there's a reasonably good following.
Well, I just wonder how the Irish will take to the little drawing of the leopard, the fighting Irish.
Yeah.
You know the logo. It's kind of...
So I did a PA at the Longford Town game, and one guy said, well, there's a guy I know, he might be good at it, so just send him up to do Longford Town Derry, and that's how I got into radio, basically.
Fantastic. I bet you're really good. We're hoping to have Kelly Pucci in here after the news, but if not, we'll talk to Tony some more. We'll get Kathy Murray on. We'll talk to Row about what she's doing. We carry on. Welcome back. We are waiting the arrival, because she is here in the building someplace. Coming up, the author, Kelly Pucci. Maybe we'll go back and check the door and see if she's out in the lobby, because she's written a fascinating book. She had written a fascinating book before. Her previous book was about Camp Douglas, which is one of the great unknown stories of Chicago. As I have Tony G, the legendary sportscaster from Ireland, on the air, let me ask you about Chicago, the reputation of Chicago overseas. You know, you hear this, oh, everybody's crazy about Chicago gangsters and blah, 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 blah. But is that still true, Tony?
Well, I tell you one thing, Chicago Bears were big in Ireland back at the time of the refrigerator, William Perry and co.
It was William Perry who finally eradicated the image of Al Capone, was it?
Basically, yes.
The Bears of 85 was a big deal there, huh?
It was, yeah. It was a story that just captured the imagination of people across the whole of Europe, I believe. Like, you know, everyone loved the Chicago Bears back then, and the only American football team that people knew anything about, really.
Well, I think one of the reasons probably was they had so many characters. I mean, it was a team filled with characters, winning the refrigerator, Perry and Jim McMahon and, you know, Mongo McMichael and, you know, some still alive. And, of course, Mike Ditka, the a character and a half. But so you, when you came here, you didn't say, take me to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. To take me to where William Perry used to eat.
Yeah, I'd rather go to the Wrigley Field now, or maybe Soldier Field, or even Chicago Fire.
Did you see Wrigley Field?
I did indeed, yeah. I was at a game back in 95. Chicago Cubs were playing the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah. They've changed. I mean, the field has changed remarkably. It's gotten a little... What do you think of it now, Dan? Compare Dan Long, the engineer, the old Wrigley to the new.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different, but I do think they did it as tastefully as they could. I think they integrated the new video boards and everything else, and, you know, there's more ads on the walls, but that's the cost of doing business in Major League Baseball, I think. But I think everything was done pretty tastefully.
What about the neighborhood?
The neighborhood is, well, you know, it lost its character, but... Some of its character, you know, Yum Yum Donuts is gone, and some of the, you know, local bars and the Taco Bell and the McDonald's, and it's you know, Ricketts theme park land now. But again, the cost of doing business in Major League Baseball, I think.
Well, thank you, Dan Long. Kelly Pucci has arrived in the studio, and we are going to talk about Chicago's first crime king. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I was worried you were going to react.
No, there's so many Lollapaloozers out there that are getting around.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I love this book.
Oh, good.
Why do you think that Michael Cassius McDonald is I, of course, knew who he was because I somewhat know something about Chicago history. Why is he a lesser-known figure? Because he is one of the most fascinating people in the history of Chicago.
He is.
And how did he get buried by history's dust?
I don't know. That's why I wrote the book. And so did Richard Lindbergh wrote a good book about 10 years ago.
I know.
About Michael Cassius McDonald. And he came to Chicago in the 1850s.
What
13 years old.
You do a lovely job of
thank you.
Capturing him before he comes here from upstate New York with a bunch of ruffians.
One of whom died mysteriously and was buried mysteriously. So we don't know if that was the beginning of his crime spree or not.
You capture it in the book, but I'm going to ask you to describe what it would be like. It would be not... I'd like to see some of these Lollapalooza kids try to make it in 1850 Chicago, wouldn't you? This was a tough town.
It was. It wasn't the town that we know now. It was famous at the time for the Sands, which is now right here, Streeterville. And what happened is John Wentworth decided to get rid of the prostitutes and the gamblers and all who were occupying the Sands, so he advertised a bogus dog track race. So all the men left and all the women were here, and then they pulled down the houses and some of them burned. And what that did is it set the stage for Michael Cassius McDonald because it spread vice all around the city.
You have a great line in here. Do you mind if I read
it? No, go right ahead.
From the book? This is, again, from Kelly Pucci's marvelous book, Chicago's First Crime King, Michael Cassius McDonald. When Michael Cassius McDonald settled in the city, Chicago tolerated all manner of vice, prostitution, gambling, and drunkenness, and did little to enforce moral laws. That's the kind of environment in which this character thrived.
It was a wild place. Literally.
Wide open, as they say.
Wide open, exactly.
He also, the one element of his, and I remember reading Richard's book some time ago and learning bits and pieces about McDonald. He was one of the great gamblers in the history of chance.
He was, and he learned on the trains. He took the train from Niagara Falls, which became famous as a honeymoon place when Napoleon Bonaparte's brother Jerry honeymooned in Niagara Falls in the early 1800s.
See, that's something I didn't know. I was wondering, well, it's pretty up there.
Oh, it is. It's very nice, and it's been the honeymoon capital. So he took the train, and he sold candy and newspapers, and he would wrap up the newspapers. When somebody got off somewhere between Niagara Falls and Chicago, he would sell the same newspaper. And then he invented the prize package, where he put $5 into a box of candy and then shuffled boxes around, and people took the boxes and nobody got the $5. But
of course.
In his spare time, he learned how to play cards. So by the time he went back and forth and back and forth, he was a superb gambler. And he was a good organizer. He saw strength in numbers and organizing both gambling and Chicago politics.
That's the thing. The legendary still going on in some ways. The relationship between crime and politics. McDonald is basically, to my mind, the founding father of, or the matchmaker between politics. It's certainly the way it reads here. He also, the beginning of one chapter, I'm just going to read you one sentence and then you can elaborate, Kelly Pucci. Chicago can thank Michael Cassius. This is something most Chicagoans would have no clue of. Chicago can thank Michael Cassius McDonald for creating the loop.
Yes.
How did he do that?
Well, with the help of his good buddy Clarence Darrow, who was a lawyer for the city of Chicago, he had a racetrack out on Lake Street near Garfield Park, and people had trouble getting there. So when Mr. Yerkes came to town after he was released from prison in Philadelphia.
What a cast of characters.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
What a cast of characters.
Yes. So Mr. Yerkes started building the L, as we call it. And he ran into a little trouble because Potter Palmer did not want the L running across the State Street entrance. So they put it, you know, put it in the back. But it didn't extend as far as the racetrack. So Mr. McDonald started having the racetrack constructed. And then he ran into some problems. So he marched into City Hall and had Clarence Darrow rewrite an ordinance. And now we have the Lake Street L.
One of the great operators of all time. He also had, and you're going to be on all the way to 11, and then you can fight your way through the crowds of kids on the way back. I'm terribly sorry about that. Lollapalooza somehow slipped my mind.
Well, it's interesting that they call the music festival Lollapalooza, since it's an old Chicago term.
It is an old Chicago term. And the other thing, I have just read a biography of P.T. Barnum.
Oh, yes.
And of course, the movie with, what's his name?
Hugh Jackson.
Jackson, the showman.
Of
Jackman. He did not coin the phrase for which he is most well known, did he? A sucker is... No, that was... There are two phrases that have gone into the American lexicon that deserve to be credited to Michael Cassius McDonald. What are those phrases, and who do they wind up being attached to?
There's a sucker born every minute, P.T. Barnum, and never give a sucker an even break, W.C. Fields. But they're both Michael Cassius McDonald.
When you started, Kelly Pucci, researching this guy, I know you probably came across him in your first fine book about Camp Douglas. That was that's a great book. And that's another unknown. You know, you were you were really digging and unearthing these fantastic stories. It was called Camp Douglas, Chicago Civil War Prison. An astonishing book. It was right down, you know, just south of where Lollapalooza is now, kind of. Just south of Lollapalooza.
Exactly.
How do you find these stories, Kelly?
Chicago Tribune archives, mostly.
No, I mean, but what strikes you at first? I mean, what perhaps in researching Camp Douglas, you came across McDonald, and I'm just curious what...
Well, my husband is a big fan of Chicago history. And he took me to the cemetery where the 4,000 Confederate soldiers are buried.
Yeah, that's something.
And there's nothing there, and you wouldn't know that they're there. And then I started researching all of the horrible things that happened there, and more prisoners died of torture and disease.
And freezing to death.
And freezing to death, right. They came with their...
These guys, remember, they're Confederate soldiers.
Right,
they're
so coming, they're from the South.
They're coming up to Chicago from Georgia and Alabama, and well, it's February.
Right, and yeah, they froze. And Abraham Lincoln's brother-in-law got into the act of providing rancid beef, and that sickened several of the people. And... some starved. It's just forgotten.
But the key to that was your husband taking you to see the so-called memorial to these people, and you started digging in that.
And then we went to the Douglas Memorial. And Douglas of Lincoln Douglas debates just happened to buy a lot of property along what would become the railroad, and he just happened to lobby in Congress so that all of the trains that go cross-country mean Chicago. So you can't go from Los Angeles to New York
unless
without
you stop
changing.
Here.
Right.
See, there's a guy. I know there have been a number of biographies written about Stephen Douglas, but there is another guy who is basically in the shadows of Chicago history where he really does not deserve to be. We've got to take a little break for a commercial or two, and we'll carry on all the way to 11 o'clock with Kelly Pucci, her new book, which you can get anywhere books are sold, online, or in stores. It's called Chicago's First Crime King. It's a great cover shot, too. It's a great... They don't make guys who look like that anymore. Michael Cassius McDonald will be right back. We're just talking about the improved roads of Ireland. Tony G is still here, and we're talking with Kelly Pucci about her really remarkable book, Chicago's First Crime King, Michael Cassius McDonald. She gives credit to our mutual friend Richard Lindbergh, who had written about him before, and you think the combination of Lindbergh and Pucci would have made, Michael Cassius McDonald ready for, you know, an HBO series his life. Well, you know, you could, Kelly, because this guy also had in his being able to marry politics and crime for maybe sort of the foundation of what became a sort of a very lucrative. You think of people like Al Capone and Big Bill Thompson. He also had among the strangest love lives.
Yes,
there are two amazing female characters in this book.
Well, actually, there are three.
That's right.
The first one was his quote wife, but they never married.
Mm-hmm.
And she was called the most beautiful girl in Chicago. Belle Jewell. She was a chorus girl. And by the time she met Michael Cassius McDonald, he was famous enough to get his name in the Trib several times. And she suddenly left to become a nun in St. Louis. And she
Which
stayed
is where
there.
Tony G is going. There's a big St. Louis connection here today. Wow.
Okay. But shortly after that, he married Mary Noonan, who was already married, and she had two children. And she had this fascination with priests. And she came to Chicago from her home in Ohio, accompanied by a priest who said he was a relative, but probably was not. And she met Michael Cassius McDonald. They got married, and she was never tried for shooting a police officer with a 20-inch revolver, which I think is pretty big.
Pretty big.
Called Pete. And she was never prosecuted for pistol whipping a woman with the 20-inch revolver. But she, before she picked up on priests again, she started an affair with an African-American minstrel performer named Billy Arlington.
You have a picture of Billy Arlington.
Yes,
he's
very,
striking, striking fellow.
Yes, he had lots of girlfriends and a wife and a daughter on the South Side. Well, she went off to California, supposedly for her health, but she was following Billy Arlington. And McDonald confronted the couple, and Billy said, you know, I'm sorry, and I have an engagement out here. I'll be staying out here. I won't be going back to Chicago. So McDonald took his wife back on the train, and at one point she had a meltdown, but he took her back, and they moved to Ashland Avenue, which was at the time where mayors lived.
Sure, and, fashionable.
Yeah, that was the place you would aspire to go to. So they built the house.
He was kind of shunned by the the elite. I mean, given his wives, he would be shunned by the elite. Yeah,
right. So the church was being built at Notre Dame. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the priests came by often to give the children religious instruction and have an affair with Mary. And they went off together. She dressed as a nun, and he as a priest.
I know
they went off to France.
That was the stuff that I hadn't remembered from Richard's book. These wild, you know, through no fault of his own, McDonald, except, you know, he was attracted to these women. I mean, these incredibly strange women.
Yes, strange indeed, yes. And he didn't take her back after she went to France,
yeah.
And she had taken several thousand dollars in cash and all of her jewelry. And one of his friends asked him, you know, what's with you and Mary? And he said, if you can't trust your wife and your parish priest, who can you trust?
No, this guy, well, the great thing about McDonald, he really had a way with words. I wish he had been able to write. I know that one of his sort of contemporaries, Bathhouse John Coughlin, would write songs. The next woman.
Oh, yes.
The next woman is, please, Kelly Pucci.
Flora Feldman.
Floradora Feldman.
Right, Floradora. She preferred to be called Dora.
One of the great names of all, Floradora Feldman.
Yes. She was married to a baseball player named Sam Barkley. And McDonald paid him several thousand dollars to divorce his wife, and they got married. And she started an affair with a teenager.
Right. I know. It just gets weirder with each wife. One shoots a cop. The next one has an affair with a teenager.
Yes. And she spent a lot of money on him. His name was Webster Guerin. And when he reached maturity, he had had enough of Floridora and said it was over. So she shot him dead.
Yeah. That you have in the book, too. The book is wonderfully illustrated. I know you got some of these from the Chicago History Museum.
Mm-hmm. And yes.
You did a marvelous job of picking judiciously in here.
Oh, thank you.
This guy, he looks like something out of a Dead End Kids movie, an mm-hmm. early Dead End Kids movie, doesn't he?
Yes.
This was her teenage lover, and she killed him.
She killed him. And she...
Went to trial.
Went to trial, but she was found not guilty.
But McDonald was already, he had died by then.
Well, he paid for her defense.
Sure.
Okay, but he didn't live to see her set free. He died with a lot of money, actually. And Mary came back into the picture, although they were divorced, and said that because he... said his last confession. He was suddenly again a devout Catholic, and she was his only wife, so she should get his money.
You have done such a remarkable job of research here, and you use it judiciously. You write here, newspapers across the country reported his death. From the Buffalo Courier, quote, Michael Cassius McDonald is dead. Like a tired child going to sleep, the man who had once held the political destinies of Chicago in the hollow of his hand, who had been the king of the gamblers and despotic ruler of the underworld that bowed in homage, passed to his final reward in the hospital at St. Anthony de Padua today.
His death was well covered in lots of papers.
Across the country.
Yes. Yes, I got tired of citing the New York Times and the Trib, so I found...
Good. No, I mean, that's a remarkable kind of paragraph.
Yes, and the way that he influenced politics is by getting the vote out several times. He had a bar in the back of his house, and this is before he got the very fabulous house, and he also naturalized citizens on the spot, so it was like one-stop shopping. They could get a free drink, something to eat, which Mary cooked, get their citizenship papers, and vote. And at the time, there were saloons where the voting
places. Sure.
And something like 15 or 20% of the aldermen owned saloons, so they could count on...
Well, through the years, Patty Bowler owned a saloon until 1967.
Right.
You must come away from your research in this with a kind of, Kelly Pucci, a kind of grudging admiration for this guy. He is, in a way, a kind of criminal genius, I think.
Yes, yes. But considering... where he came from. I mean, he was just a teenager.
He was 13 years old, coming down from Buffalo or somewhere mm-hmm. in upstate New York mm-hmm. to become this titan of Chicago. Another interesting thing before I let you go, and thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. It,
one of his proteges was James O'Leary.
Yes.
Who wound up being, later on, one of the gambling kings of Chicago with
yes.
a huge... gambling complex in the Stockyard neighborhood, mm-hmm. who also happened to be the son of who, Kelly Pucci?
Mrs. O'Leary with the cow.
This
yes.
is, have you been fascinated with Chicago history your entire life?
Pretty much, yes, yes. I wish I had lived earlier. The best time to be alive would have been during the World's Fair.
You want to be...
Would love to see electricity at night.
Well, it would be great if you were live in the World's Fair and looked out for the one guy who was prowling the World's Fair looking for pretty women to...
Oh, which McDonald may have had some part in, because he,
and the
he
devil
got
in
all
White
the gamblers
City.
And the crooks together and said, don't go to the fair. Don't prey on people going into the fair. And I think it gave women a false sense of of safety.
Oh, my and God. So that H.H. Holmes could wander as much as he wants.
Yes,
you got another book? Him. You got another book in you?
Yeah.
Can you give me it?
No.
You are too much. It's not a long book. It is tightly written and deeply researched. And she says at the end, at a conclusion, that Michael Cassius McDonald was uniquely a Chicagoan. You, Kelly Pucci, are uniquely a Chicago historian. I love this
book.
Thank you. I think it's great. And the story is one that needs to be told. You could make a Martin Scorsese could make a movie just called Three Wives. These wives are unbelievable.
Right.
Well, you get through the Lollapalooza crowd on your way home. Thanks for getting through it on the way here. Thank you, Ro Coleman, for producing. Thank you, Dan Long, for engineering. Tony G, you're going on from here. You'll be here another day. Then you're going to San Francisco. Then you're going to Las Vegas. And next trip, you're going to St. Louis and Boston. Well, I'm going to make you come here on your next trip. It's been great to see you. Thank you all for listening, and I'll yammer on next week.